Thanks for tuning in to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and our Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. Reviews are always welcome, and you can also send us all your comments or questions, reflections, and just what you're thinking about in theater and the theater industry right now to our email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com.
Recording.
Recording.
I'm recording. What up, what up? Here we are. Hello and welcome. Welcome, everyone. Here we are on a beautiful day in March to discuss and analyze and break down what the hell we are doing in this industry in this wild and crazy time. My name is Sophie Payton, and I'm here today with our badass collective members, Oogie and Sequoia. And we're going to dive into an article called From Nicety to Necessity. And just to start us off, let's go around and just share our name, pronoun, land acknowledgement, and what your theater discipline or focus is. And let's also just do a little check-in. I'm curious to hear from both of you, just sort of what you're carrying into the space today, and what are perhaps some of the things that you want to leave behind or leave out of this space. And so just sort of like what's on your heart and like maybe what's creeping in that you're trying to like quiet or settle down. Oogie, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, sure. It's great to be here. My name is Oogie, she, her, hers. I am Squawky from Tama, Iowa, but I am phoning in from St. Paul, Minnesota, land of the Dakota people, the right side of the river. I am an actor and currently a new writer, and I am working on Men on Boats with the university for one scene. And we're actually filming today. So I don't know, a little anxiety, I guess, or I guess excitement, not anxiety, but like also I need to run lines and get ready, you know, all that stuff. We're going to film it and then they're going to piece it together with the students. And I'm also working on a documentary as a production assistant with TPT PBS. Called Bring Her Home, focusing on missing and murdered Indigenous women and the women who are doing the work. And I'm about to start Zoom rehearsals for the Empathy Project and also Zoom rehearsals for Breaking Ice with Pillsbury House in Theater and the Incarceration Play Project with Wonderlust Productions. We work on a show for like 2 years interviewing communities, and the next one is the Incarceration Play Project. And then we set them to a sort of fairy tale to tell the story. And it's Minotaur, the Maze and the Minotaur. Mm-hmm. And we're workshopping the script and hopefully can do it in person with the community that previously incarcerated, family members of those who are incarcerated. I'm also writing a short play for Wonderlust. For Hopscotch, it's going to be a short play festival, and we're envisioning the future in our scripts. So I'm super excited about that.
I love Wonderlust so much. What's on your heart?
What's on my heart? I am a grandma now. Three of my nieces have had babies, so I'm a grandma.
Congratulations.
And I can't wait to meet them. I'm getting my second vaccination shot. Next week, and after that, I'm going to be hugging some babies.
I love it. What about you, Sequoia?
Yeah, Buju Anin and Dinaway Maganaga Doug. I'm Sequoia Hawk. I use she and they pronouns. My family is Anishinaabe and Hoopa, and I'm currently calling in from the land of the Dakota in what is now currently St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a filmmaker, a theater maker, a poet, most recently an opera director, and currently I'm working on a documentary with St. Paul Neighborhood Network and their New Angles Fellowship to tell a story of justice families, of Native families who've had someone killed by the police, to tell their story sort of for the first time in that big public sphere. So that's kind of also what's a little bit on my heart today as I've been doing interviews with them sort of over Zoom and over phone calls and in person. And so, you know, bringing that into the space and knowing that that's been happening. And also, I think I have also like a little vaccine hookup maybe next week. So I'm sort of like waiting for the text message to be like, you can go get it. And then I'm going to be like, I'm going to run and go get it. So that's basically all I'm really thinking about in my life.
That's so exciting. My name is Sophie. As I said, I use she, her pronouns. I'm also on the land of the Dakota people as well in South Minneapolis. And I'm primarily a director and producer and dramaturg. And I'm also currently training to be an intimacy director coordinator, and something that I'm really passionate about sort of folding into my theatrical and directorial work. I mostly work in new work and musical theater development. And so I'm primarily sort of working a lot with playwrights and living playwrights. But in the pandemic times, I'm not really practicing theater much at all right now. And part of it is just like, I'm sort of at a roadblock a little bit with like being able to push my craft forward, because I just can't stop worrying about what the work environment's going to be when I can actually do that craft with people again. And so I'm mostly spending my time right now trying to work on how do we want to work in theater and how do we want to come back? And so until I feel like I can at least sort of urgently answer some of those questions and like urgently make some of those shifts, that's just sort of where my head is at right now, is focusing on some of those things before I can sort of put my head back in an artistic or artistry space. So that's sort of what I'm currently working on. So for our episode today, we are talking about, as I said, the article From Nicety to Necessity. And this was written by Jack Ruler, the artistic director of Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis. It was published just this past fall in October of 2020 on HowlRound. And it's part of a curated series by Mark Valdez called Searching a Way Forward. In this article, Jack talks about sort of theater as a whole and like where theater is going now in like post-pandemic world. He talks about the pandemic as an equalizer and how he feels that companies that don't rely on ticket sales maybe sort of more have more viability and sort of may surface as the new sages in our industry. He talks a little bit about sort of how do we adapt the purpose of theater and sort of shift our priorities and values and think about sort of in post-pandemic, like where is theater's purpose in our society as a larger factor? He talks about power quite a bit and the power of this moment. And specifically, he says, quote, "We are in, I believe, a rare moment when those insisting on revolution and those with the authority to affect change want the same thing." I think that is a quote that has a lot of unpacking to do. But in some ways, I do believe that there is some truth in that, that I do think we are at a time in our country where we have, for the first time, the majority of people do agree that racism exists and do agree that systemic oppression and systemic racism exists. And I do think that there is some power in that moment. He goes on to talk about relationships as currency, talks a little bit about sort of how do we in the business of theater shift if we're keeping relationships at the center of our work. What does that mean for money? He says in the article, quote, "If relationships are currency, the money will follow." Another quote I think needs quite a bit of unpacking, but it's sort of interesting to think about sort of in episode 5, our last episode, they spoke a bit about sort of what is the product of theater. And so I think this is sort of in the article, Jack's way of sort of framing if the product is people, relationships, building community, then sort of where does money fall into that? He talks a little bit about some of the work Mixed Blood is doing. And he closes with the fact that theater is the, quote, proverbial cockroach in the apocalypse. He says that theater won't go away, but that the future of theater will likely have flatter leadership structure and center community more. So it's a pretty dense article. And something that the reason I brought this article to the group and felt excited about it is I do feel like there's a lot of truth in here. But I also sort of feel that from where Jack sits, as a person holding power in the theater industry locally and nationwide, that he sort of can sit and hypothesize and dream and envision these big statements about like relationships are currency and the money will follow. But for us, like we are the working artists on the ground, like having to like survive right now and rebuild our careers, find a way to like want to stay in this work or to find a place in this work. And like, there just feels like there's a lot more here than just sort of stating things like some big quote in this article that feels really telling, like that theater is wildly essential, or I don't know, but it just feels like there's so much in what he talks about that I feel like we really just need to explore, like, where is the truth in what he says and what he's seeing? And then also, like, what is he super not seeing? And for folks like us who are like freelance artists and working and like in the grind, what do we do about it now? Because I don't know about the two of you, but like, I'm not interested in like waiting for 5 years to like see if it's not quite as abusive to work in theater. We're just not there. So that was some of like the big reasons I was excited to bring this article up. And the quote that I shared with the two of you that really stuck out to me in this article is, theater must produce something more than catharsis or nostalgia, something greater than empathy, political enlightenment, or awareness, something more enduring than an enlightened conversation on the way home from the theater. I contend that there must be a call to action, or that the piece of theater be the enzyme that catalyzes revolution of social malaise. Cross-sector work will define impact in unprecedented ways. So, you know, for me personally, I really identified with the fact that we were moving away from theater as a good conversation on the way home, or theater as like this tiny blip of catharsis or something like that, and starting to think about it as something that is just much bigger and much more essential than that. So, to start us off, thinking big, who is this new idea of necessity for? And is it a necessity for people of color or for BIPOC folks, or is it for white people?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the title of the article, From Nicety to Necessity, really got me thinking about the fact that, well, Jack, for one thing, as a white man perceiving, like, is for me thinking of theater in a way that if it already wasn't a necessity to white folks, theater would have died, right? So now thinking of it as, well, if it's already a thing that's a necessity to these folks, then why hasn't it become a necessity to other people of color and Native and BIPOC folks? And there's a reason sort of for that. And now that we've come to this moment and realizing, oh, we fucked up, basically. Something is wrong here. We need to change it. But not still understanding that what needs to be changed isn't this idea of, oh, it's a nicety for, you know, for white folks or older folks, but it already actually is that. What you really need to do is change it to like a necessity to everybody in the whole world, basically.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I remember being in grad school and learning about Federico Garcia Lorca, who founded La Baraca Theater Company, and they traveled around Spain to rural villages because Federico believes that everybody should have access to classical plays and sort of made it his mission to make sure as many people as possible saw. So I've always had this dream of like sharing theater with, you know, reservations or villages or, you know, native communities, because our entire culture is based off of storytelling. Our languages are learned by listening and, you know, hearing it and interacting with it. So to me, it's the most natural thing. It's already a necessity.
What I hear you're saying, Ubi, is it's never been just a nicety. For Native folks, for us, that's always been ingrained. And that's, I feel like, very true for a lot of BIPOC folks.
Yeah.
And so then my question is, like, where is the disconnect, right? Because like, pandemic crisis hit, we still now a year in, no one cares that our industry is struggling. There's no help coming. There's no relief. So like, societally, we are, what I, you know, I take where money goes as a value. And so like, to me, it seems like we are not valued as a necessity at all in the broader scope of things. So then like my question back to you both is then, what is that disconnect between like community necessity and need and like industry discrepancy maybe?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that just keeps popping up in my mind is, you know, as an actor, I'm speaking from the perspective of an actor, actors are not valued in society. You know, people's, the first thing they say is they should shut their mouth and just be an actor. But as soon as COVID hit, everybody was locked down, shelter in place. What did people do? They turned to Netflix, they turned to Amazon, Hulu, Disney Plus. If there weren't actors, what would everybody be doing? And it's just sort of like this accepted belief that we don't matter, even though everybody turns to actors in times of when they don't have something to do.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I can say for my family, right, that this is not an industry that was like, or a job that was like, oh, we're so excited for you to go into this like really difficult struggle, hard to find stability in job. And granted, there is support there, but at the same time, there's always sort of that side eye of like, oh yeah, you're a theater person. Like, oh, okay. Like do you do that for work though? Or is that just like for fun? And it's like, no, this is like my career. This is my profession. And what I'm sort of struggling with is like, you then go home to stream all of your Netflix and side eye me when most of those people also got their degree in theater. And that's how they like got into the work that they're also doing. And so is it an unawareness of sort of where that skill or education is coming from? Like, do people not look to that mass media and realize where its root is?
Well, and also I think people probably don't understand the amount of work that goes into theater and producing a play and how collaborative it is. And, you know, it teaches you how to work with people. It teaches you how to work independently. It teaches you how to be creative and be a problem solver. And I think that's why theater has endured for as long as it has, because of these elements. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I also think this idea of a product is really interesting with theater, because someone's always trying to figure out, is the product is performance, like they sort of talked about in the last episode or in this article, the community being the product, the engagement, but it's almost like there is no one product. Every experience that you have in theater is basically why we do it. Like we do it because we have fun or we enjoy, or all the things Ugi just said. And like, that's what makes me at least continue to want to do theater, is those fun things and not like creating this beautiful show or these community engagement or meeting new people. All those things are like, yes, and to theater to me.
I think that's what's been so challenging about the isolation of this pandemic, is that, you know, I'm mostly a director. And so like, I can't really do anything I want to do alone. I can't do that like in my house and just be a director without the people and the community. And like, I love what you said, Sequoia, because it just makes me think, you know, maybe the product isn't the same production to production, company to company, show to show. Like maybe the industry doesn't have a definable product. Which also makes me think a little bit about what Anna Sophia was saying in the last episode of thinking about fundraising and thinking about funding. And, you know, if we don't have a defined product, which like maybe is an exciting, unique thing we should lean into, then we definitely can't fit into your measurable outcomes of what that product did or how that product was received, to have some sort of quantitative response from that. But I'm like really holding on to that idea of like, maybe there isn't a singular product.
And taking that back, like they're all though trying to follow a similar business model or similar theater model. Maybe that is the problem that we're all working with right now, is we're trying to all fit in the same box, even though we can't do that.
And like, it's not serving anyone. Like it's not like more fun as an audience member or like a person who's like receiving that art when it's all fit into the same box either. Like I do sort of wish, you know, living in Minneapolis, I wish that there were things, stories, art, theater happening here that was super different from other communities. It wasn't trying to replicate other communities, but was like just true to like being here and what's unique about being here. Because, you know, I'm originally from the East Coast and moved here like 4.5-ish years ago now. And like, I had a little bit of culture shock coming here, and have now that I've been here for a while and like really interested in like the history of this part of the country. And like, there's a totally different style of architecture. There's like a totally different history of so many different things. And I would be more interested in having art and theater that is like centered around what's happening here and is like more specific to that than just trying to sort of, like you're saying, Sequoia, just like fit on the hat of the thing of the business model that everything else does. I'm interested in what we sort of talked about at the very beginning of who is this necessity for? And what both of you sort of echoed, in a lot of communities of color, like this has always been a necessity and hasn't really faltered. And so I'm wondering sort of in that necessity, like pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, like where does that live? Like, where do you feel like that lives? And also to just touch on sort of like who was doing this work before and like who, it's a big question, but also like who are you looking to now for who's sort of like carrying that same feeling of necessity and urgency forward?
I definitely gravitate towards theater companies that have a sort of community-driven focus. That's, I mean, from Wonderlust Productions, you know, Full Circle, Pillsbury, they're all driven by community and the specific community that they're working with. And, well, I would say the people that I worked with pre-pandemic are still working. Like, they never stopped. Nothing stopped for us anyway. And everybody's just figuring out this new landscape. I mean, they're still working. I don't know. I guess I'm just having a hard time with that question.
I feel like I have a really hard time with that question too, because I'm in this space where pre-pandemic, I totally agree. I was like community engaged, focused theater was my jam, native theater. And then this pandemic happened and I sort of lost this love of theater and started getting more into filmmaking and doing those things. And then when people started asking me like, hey, we figured out Zoom. Do you want to stage manage this thing or do you want to do this? I was like, sure, let me check this out. And I'm a little like concerned about what theater looks like after, or more like I'm concerned about where I feel like I fit in theater after this pandemic, because I almost feel like I have reevaluated my priorities almost of like, I love theater and theater will always be my first sort of like jump into all the art making that I do. But it, the way in which it's so like traumatic to do itself, it's so taxing. It's so, you get little pay, you have all these things. It's very demanding as a person that I'm like, is this even something that I feel like I can continue doing, honestly? And so I'm in this moment of, I don't even know where theater lives in my life right now.
And like, can you wait for those things to change? Can you wait for artists, actors to pay to be valued more? Can you wait for that culture, that internal work culture to like shift away from these like super capitalist abusive systems? Or do you, like you're saying, just shift to a different artistry that like is more fulfilling and just feels better and like doesn't have to have so much taxing and feel like you lose so much in going through it?
Right. And there's this whole idea that like, I still know that I will do theater because it's just part of me. But why then would I like go into this building that's going to give me rules and write a bunch of grants for these things that we maybe not get and work with people who I don't even want to work with because the ED said I had to. And like all of these things when I could just like do a production myself, sort of grassroots, and not have to have sort of that toxic culture without creating my own theater company right now at 23 years old, that also becomes a whole thing. And so like there's ways in which I can't figure out what my end goal is with it, because it's like, do I completely disregard this capital notion that's going on right now with theater and try to do my own, even though it probably might still have capitalistic notions, because apparently we don't know how to do theater without that right now. And so like my brain doesn't quite know ways in which, like, I know personally what I would want to do. Like, I know that I'd want to get a bunch of people together and just like have fun and like enjoying a moment in space to tell a story. But the ways in which theater then upholds like, oh, then you need people to come and you need lights and sound and you need things, like where I'm like, well, I would rather just get people together to hang out, honestly. But that's, is that theater? I don't know. I mean, yes, and maybe not.
I mean, yes, and like, I mean, I think that's definitely theater. But I would say I very much agree with you, because I feel like I don't know what that end goal is for me at all, especially now. And I feel like I have for so much of my career, like forced myself to have an answer to that question. And of course, all of this is like, no, I have no fucking answer to that question anymore. And that answer will like happen over time. But I do feel like weirdly tied to the like industry thing of it, that there's like something that pulls me into the like, but I'd rather be there and make it better than just run away from it. Or not run away feels like a strong word, but then just sort of, you're saying, just like be totally devoid of that capitalist bullshit and just like make something else that is centered in the values and priorities that like you can have control over, because you're not under this sort of big umbrella of nonsense. So I'm just reflecting on it in this conversation with the two of you of like, as you said that, Sequoia, I'm like, I'm still pulled to that industry and to that business of being like, okay, but how do we get people paid more? How do we shift the contract model so that like, you know, maybe it's not the actors who are on contract. Maybe it's the marketing department that's on contract instead. And it's like the actors and the technicians and the stage managers and the directors are like full-time salaried employees. And like we upend the contract system. And I do also want to throw credit to Sima Suko, who is an artist leader in our country who also had that idea, who I read an interview about. So that is not like my original thought. But so I'm interested in sort of some of those things. Oogie, where do you stand?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I agree that actors should be paid more, that, you know, you don't have a show if you don't have actors. You can have a script and you can have amazing lights and sound, but if you don't have actors on stage, you don't have a play. And it's just back to what I said earlier, that there's really no respect for actors in a way. But I agree that there needs to be a shift in how people are paid and who's paid what. I would like to see a more equitable pay across the board, because, I mean, at least what I was taught in theater is that it takes everybody to make this one thing. It doesn't matter how small your role is, like everybody's important, and the pay scale does not reflect that.
So in like recognizing that we have bills to pay, this is the thing we want to be compensated for, to like make our life and to have the things that we need, then like, where is the balance? Like, I find myself sort of thinking a little bit about what Shalana talked about on the last episode of a company model where there is a for-profit something funding the work. And I feel like that's sort of how a lot of us function now, is like we have the jobs that give us the money so we can do the projects we actually want to do and spend time on. And as much as I like do feel somewhat okay about that, because I do think it allows flexibility to say no, it allows space to be able to like pick the things you really want to work on and then be able to dive into that instead of just having to like take everything that comes. And some of those shows that like maybe don't fit into your moral compass or like your values and have to take them anyway. So like, I appreciate the flexibility that comes with that, but I'm also like sitting here almost like a pestilent child, just like, but I want to be paid for my work. I want a salary. Like, I don't want to have to be a starving artist. And I don't believe that we should have to be. I do believe that we should be valued. I think we should be essential. I think we should be paid. And I don't want to have to, I don't want to be in an industry that uplifts Netflix and then like poo-poos all of us. And like, then puts us through these theater programs. I mean, now I'm off on a tangent, but like puts us through these educational systems too, where we like pay all this money to get like very little actual experience to do this job and to survive in the industry. And then like push us out the door to just like undervalue our labor and internships and like undervalue our labor as emerging artists. And then like, you just sort of have to like scrap together a lifestyle. Like that's no way to live. And I don't know what to do about that.
Yeah. I know. I have some dreams. Hopefully they work. But, you know, I am definitely tired of writing grants and waiting to see if we'll get it, or waiting to see if there's an email asking me if I want to do a show. I definitely want to be proactive and just making shit, because I have a compulsion to tell stories. Like, it's just something that I have to do, is tell stories. And I feel like there's a lot of talking and debate about what it should be and what it shouldn't be. And, you know, I agree with a lot of things about how demanding theater can be, like the 10 out of 12s. I know there's like conversations about, you know, we should get rid of them. I mean, that's fine. I think in the place that we're at now, people are thinking more about self-care and mental health. And I hope and believe that these epiphanies will stay with people as we come out of the pandemic, and it'll just naturally be a part of how we go about our business, how we go about our lives, is hopefully taking mental health into account. And I think that needs to be the future of theater. Taking care of ourselves and taking care of each other, and, you know, checking in and not just make it function as a corporation, you know, of everybody's just a cog in the wheel, but we're all there. We're actually there to tell a story together.
So jumping off of that, Oogie, in talking about people's needs and talking about mental health, where, if at all, do people's needs then fit into that? Can they fit into that? Do they fit into that?
As far as like business goes, people's needs are never taken into consideration. I saw this great meme on Facebook. It was like a giant boat with like a smaller boat going inside of it. And they're like, CEO says you can't raise the minimum wage from $7.25 because I'm trying to park my boat inside my boat or something like that. I don't know. I guess capitalism just makes me so upset. I mean, the entire system is set up to benefit the few and everybody else works for them. And that just, I don't know, we just have to move on from that and create a new way.
I also feel like I take it a step further and like talk about it as like the American capitalist system is just also what's really at root here. It's not even like the theater capitalist system that's been created, but like the fact that of the capitalistic notions of entire America as a country is rooted in this problem, and that like that also is what's affecting theater. Because like if we all had universal health care, then maybe we could all do some other things with that as well. Because I mean, I feel like I'm never going to get health care with any theater job I ever do. And that's like so true. And so like all of those bigger systematic things also play into the fact in which why theater has no money and the needs of people are not put in because we live in America. And they just care about capitalism and colonization. So there's that. Which I don't have any, you know, I don't have any goals or like, I mean, I have goals, but I don't have any like ways in which to fix that because that's such a, you know, that's like America's root cause from the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, the only future that I want to envision is self-sustaining energy, powering a building, having food grown on your property, having housing for your artists, designers. And I guess I just envision like this little commune of like a theater space and living space. I mean, that's what I envision. To not have a physical space like the Gremlin or the Guthrie or, you know, wherever. Because theater is like so deeply ingrained in me now. I've done it for like 20 years and I don't see a life without it, but I want it to work from home. That's what COVID taught me is that I like working from home. I just want other people to come and work with me. And we just have our own little space and just do it, you know? Because, you know, Jack says in his article about how it's like there's going to be simultaneous movements happening. And so I feel like that's what we need to do. Instead of like focusing on trying to get into, you know, predominantly white theaters for prestige or whatever, let's just make our own shit. I mean, like as a Native theater maker, when I first started studying theater, it was Native theater and there was just no other option. Like it wasn't an option to try to get into predominantly white theater. And even when I do work with predominantly white theater, I'm not comfortable in the roles because I want to tell Native stories. I want to tell my stories. And I feel like that's just what we all have to do is make our own shit. And then I feel like, and then the money will follow. I don't know.
I want that with like every fiber of my being. That like theater commune you described, I'm like that's what I want. I want that so bad. And like you're, I mean, I think the only way to move forward is working with simultaneous movements. The way that we have worked previously is sequential movements. And that's why we're still here. That's why we've had to like continue to just like do the fight again every 20 years once once white people sort of come back around to like having consciousness about it and like, you know, have their whatever. It's a very inarticulate way to say that, but I want that. And I want to know how to get to that.
Just do it. I mean, like, I agree, relationships are currency, especially in the theater industry. Like, most of the gigs I got was because of a previous job that I had, and then somebody passed my name along, and then, you know, they want to hire me again and hire me again because I show up, I do a good job, and mind my business. But I feel like there's enough of us that we can work together and just make shit happen. That's my answer.
But it's also these radical, or I mean, I don't think it's that radical, but I could see how people use that as your co-op commune idea of like that is sort of where theater needs to start leaning towards, is this idea of sustainability, not just amongst the industry, but like of its people, providing food, housing, like all of these things, because that's really the base needs of actors and artists among theater. And once we cover those, like you said, the money and the art, it will come. But like the needs of people is also something we need to start looking at heavily.
How can we start that without the money first? And is there a business model in there, or is business model not even the right terminology to use?
I don't know what the answer is for everybody else, but in my dream of my self-sustaining theater artist commune.
Yes, give us the dream.
I want to get recording equipment, quality cameras and sound. And like, I want to record theater. I want to make movies. I want to, you know, the business would be the production company of making commercials or industrials or, you know, whatever. And then that funnels into theater. That's the best I can come up with, I guess. But it sounds manageable to me. And I'm already talking with people who are interested in doing this with me. It's just how I roll. Let's just do it.
But like, I feel like that's why it works, is because you know what you want and you know your community and you know the people whose story you want to tell and are telling. And so I feel like that's why the thriving theater companies right now are the smaller ones who are community-based focused, because they know their whole shtick. Like, they know what they're doing. And the other ones who've been following these business models and these like other layers in which people have also presented to them are struggling because they need to look at it more of an individual basis. Like, there is no one business model that all theaters can follow, because they need to think about themselves as individuals, even if they're a business, because that's sort of this idea of one for all does not work.
Yes, this makes me very excited. I'm also wondering, so then is there a need for national theater? So then like, is there even a purpose for this like larger scale? Because I think, you know, Broadway and Broadway tours to me are like the most corporate sort of capitalist version of our industry. And do we even need that at all?
No. I mean, I never felt like it was accessible to me. So I don't find it a necessity at all. You know, I could never afford to go watch the shows. I don't like a lot of people. So like, being in New York with millions of people, like, that's just too much. I'm a country girl. I'm happy with like a little theater to tell stories and tour shows, tell stories with native voices, telling our stories. Because I feel like, this is a tangent, but I feel like from the representation perspective, we've been dehumanized for so long in media, in film, in society, in culture, that the necessity is getting Black and Brown voices on stage to tell our stories from our perspectives, because of how we have been represented on stage and on film, on TV, that we are not seen as human. And the larger problems that we're having with the racism and the systemic, like all of it, until we're seen as human beings, there's not going to be any justice for us. There's not going to be room for us anywhere. And to me, that's the necessity of theater, of telling our stories. And we've never been nice about it, because our stories are not nice. I mean, I do want to get away from trauma porn, for sure. But also, we need to tell our stories. And places like Broadway, they would never. I think it was Marissa Carr did a video of like all the native lines that are on Broadway. And it was not many. So Broadway has never been a place for me. That's why I'm perfectly happy and fine to make my own shit or work with people who are making their own shit. We tell great stories. We wake people up and people take action just from watching our shows. Like, it's already a necessity. I guess that's the one thing that I disagree with about this article is this would be a very different article if somebody like us was writing it. I mean, it wouldn't even be a question. And the only constant in life is change. That's what I learned. It was drilled into me in grad school that the only constant in life is change. And it's our job as theater makers to be adaptive, creative problem solvers. And I feel like we're still doing that.
I vote Oogie for president of theater.
I second it.
It just makes me think about, like, I mean, the representation piece is so key, which is sort of why I asked that question, because I do think that there's something about the larger national scope of what you're saying that, like, that representation is so key and so important to see that humanity and to find that humanity. But in, like you're saying, there were no fucking audience members taking action after going to Broadway, you know, and I would say that maybe there were a couple more when it was Slave Play on Broadway. But there still weren't a lot that were doing any action, even when it was a super provocative, super interesting, super complicated intersectional story. And it makes me start to think it's just breaking it all down, right? So if in most communities, in cities, in smaller places, in towns, in neighborhoods, if we had these stories that were part of those people, we don't actually need some sort of larger national narrative about any of it. Because you should actually just understand the people next door to you and the people across the street and the people across town. And those people aren't going to be the same, even if they identify the same as those people in that other town or that other city. And so, like, why the fuck are we flocking to New York to go, like, I mean, for white people, it's to, like, go get your culture and, like, take it with you and go home. And then they never do anything with it. And, you know, I mean, I think Lady Dane in episode 4 said it really well of just, like, there are so many theater people who go in and watch Black and Brown Bodies on stage and they feel and they cry and they think it's a great story. And then they go out and they fucking vote for Trump and vote against all of those rights and against all of that, against what they supposedly felt when they were in that space. That humanity disappears when they leave the theater. And maybe that is what it is. Maybe that's that humanity just has to be found in those small spaces, because otherwise, like, it does not seem like it has worked the other way around.
Yeah.
So as we talked about a little bit earlier, Jack talks a bit about power in this article. And specifically, he says, as I quoted before, we are in, I believe, a rare moment when those insisting on revolution and those with the authority to effect change want the same thing. I don't feel like this is entirely true. As I said before, I think there is some truth in it, but I don't feel like he is correct here. And I'm curious what both of you think.
I feel like if those in power wanted the same changes that we want, those changes would be made. And stop. I mean, we're in the Twin Cities and it's the Derek, what's his face trial? What is his name?
Chauvinist.
Chauvinist Derek Chauvin, his trial is happening, and you know there's like calls for safety, and you know, but it's like this it's happening because they murdered a citizen and then defended the murderers, protected them. And so, like, I get really triggered by this. Those with the authority to effect change want the same thing. No, they don't. They want to make things stay the same. And I don't know. It's just super triggering, I guess. And makes me very angry because I don't know. I mean, maybe in other parts, like, I've seen some really cool posts about, like, theater who, like, the entire boards wiped clean so that they can have a more diverse board. So in that sense, I agree with him that there are organizations that have the power to affect change and are working on it. But in the larger picture. You know, we're still in it. And we don't, I mean, I don't know. I'm just like really interested to see how this trial pans out, whether he'll be charged or not, or just because he's a white guy, he'll be let go, and what that's going to do to the city. I don't know. I don't know. I guess it's just a hard moment in time for us here in the Twin Cities, I think.
Yeah, I'm feeling that for sure. It's also hard to see the super intense militarization of spaces in our city right now, because it feels like you're saying, Ugi, like they've just anticipated the result of the trial before they've even picked the jurors. Mm-hmm. So I hear you on how wrong this statement and sentiment feels. This is another thing. I do sort of think about white privilege, walking through doors, opportunities sort of being laid out for you, no accountability, all that. This is not to say that like white people don't have hardship, which like I don't even want to give that preface, but when things work for you and you don't have to try very hard, how smart does that make you? Like how well equipped are you to handle struggle and challenge? And like you're saying, adaptability, sustainability, if things have like mostly worked. And even when things are hard, they like still usually work out. Like even if it's like hard to get the unemployment or like hard to figure out the thing, like you still usually get to the person and things usually work out because you have privilege. And so then like stupid, simplistic way to distill that down, are white people ill-equipped for a moment of hardship, for this moment of hardship? That's just something that I've been thinking about in relation to change and in relation to like you're saying, if you want to change, you just change. You can just do it. It's not this whole like debate and like years and years of back and forth. If you just wanted it, you just did it because you have the power to do it. And so it would just be here. It would just have happened. You know, I think the We See You White American Theater demands are a blueprint. They're not like a debatable topic. They're like literally just a guideline. You can just like do what they said. It's not that hard. You can just like implement the things that they said. They really laid it out.
I agree with you because I feel like he is coming from a place of privilege in saying, I believe we're in a rare moment that this is a revolution happening, basically. Like we have been having small revolutions. Like everyone who was a part of the We See You White American Theater has in their own way had a tiny revolution somewhere. And we finally had a moment during the pandemic, or I should say they, I was not a part of writing it, but they had a moment to then be able to come together and write this whole thing that I know they have been thinking about for years, their whole life, because like that's just basically what, as people of color in theater, we've been dealing with this entire time. And because we had a moment to like breathe at home during this pandemic, then this was able to like get written and felt like it was like, okay, we finally need to do some shit. Something needs to happen. But I think the privilege moment of that is it wasn't like a rare moment and it wasn't something that came out of this pandemic. It has always been happening.
And it seems kind of dismissive of previous revolutions. Like, you know, you have the suffragettes, you have the civil rights, American Indian movement. We've always been in revolution mode since the founding of this country. It's not a rare moment.
It is an extremely rare moment for white people.
For white people, yes. Mm-hmm.
And like, because we live in white supremacy in this like sick, twisted way, like that dictates the pace of progress is like whether white people are like awake about it yet or not. And like in the 60s and 70s, they were awake for a moment. And then they weren't in the 80s and 90s and the war on drugs and like the AIDS crisis. Like they just were sort of like, not our issue. This, we're not going to look at this one. And now suddenly we're in this other moment where white people are paying attention again. And so, yeah, it's a rare moment for white people. And like, I feel like deep down in my gut of just like, I don't want any of my white people to go back to that ever again. Like, I want to make sure like you cannot close your eyes again. We can't do this again. My kids can't do this again. And like, you know, my parents were hippies, you know, were very anti-capitalist and very free love. And like, if they kept fighting, I wouldn't have to do this. If they kept their community going, if they kept their people going, I maybe wouldn't have to do this. And I'm like, sure as fucking not okay with like my kids having to do this in the same way.
It's just, it's never going to benefit the people if we continue to uphold this white supremacist structure. And I agree with you. It's the people, the individual groups here and there, everywhere. Like it's going to take all of us. So we got to do what we can individually do. And that's how it's going to change. Like we can't depend on this structure or this, I don't even know what you call it. I just want to call it a beast, I guess. I don't know how to explain that.
Yes, I hear that you're saying a call to action. So everybody listen to Oogie and let's make some change.
And I'm like really carrying forth that call to action from Oogie and from Sequoia, from both of you. So just thank you for that. Thank you for your brains and your insight and your time and your ideas and your experiences. And like, I am going to carry them out of this conversation and like really hold them deep and hold them strongly. What I'll say is like, I feel, even if we didn't touch on everything, I do feel like I've gotten some big takeaways from things that we've said. And like, I wonder if maybe that's, if both of you also feel that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So I'll ask the two of you just like lingering questions, lingering thoughts. Is there something that you're carrying with you out of this discussion today?
I think after having this conversation, I'm a lot more motivated. I don't have any questions. I just know what I want to do and it's time to do it.
Yeah, I feel similar. I'm like, there are ways in which I can still find joy in this. And also like, there are people out there still thinking like I'm thinking, which is something that I think I don't hear on the mainstream. And so to know that at least in small bubbles, it still exists, it's nice.
Yeah, I think I'm really carrying with me this idea of like, what is the actual purpose of a national theater presence? And like, I'm not sure we actually need it. And there isn't a singular product. There isn't a singular model that we've zoomed out too much. And we sort of need to like simultaneously zoom in and like keep all of our periphery like on alert. So I'm really taking with me that because I feel like that's something I haven't gotten to in conversations about theater and theater systems with other people before, is sort of this idea of maybe there just like isn't an answer to those things. Like maybe it is just person to person, company to company. And like that's where those answers lie. And you just have to answer it for like you and your people. And there's no like fix. There's no like, this is what the theater industry needs to do. And I like really appreciate that because I feel like you're saying, there's like motivation in that. There's like freedom in that. And there's like what feels like a way more exciting way to work and way to do theater in a way that feels way more fulfilling, like, I don't know, heartfelt. I'm not sure what word I'm going for, but that's what I'm taking away with me.
Yeah.
For those people in power who may be listening or who may hear this at some point, I do just want to say like that isn't serving that tiny community that you're serving anyway. Those older white cis patrons who are giving you all your money that you are like fighting to keep this model for, you're not helping them either. They're not living better lives. They're not adding back to the community. They are like having a singular moment in your space and then they are leaving and they are never thinking about it again. And that's not serving any of us. That's all I got. I just want to say thank you. I feel like we had some semblance of a structure to this conversation and like did not stick to it in the most exciting way possible. The only thing you have to do is do plugs.
Well, I would like to invite everyone to pop over to www.fullcircletheatermn.org. For more information about the Empathy Project, we will have Zoom presentations March 26th at 7 p.m. and March 27th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. And there'll be more information on the Full Circle Theater MN.org site. And I also would like to say, go and visit Wanderlust Productions. There's a web series on overachievers. I'm in it. I think I'm in episode 5. And we're actually created a graphic novel that will be out in next year, maybe. I can't remember. But it's a graphic novel based off of our play, The Adoption Play Project. And it's super gorgeous and awesome. And it was theater with music in it. And it's sort of translated into the graphic novel. And it's going to be really cool. And I'm in it.
That's so cool. Do you also want to plug Auntie Oogie Presents?
Oh, yeah. And so pop over to YouTube and search for Auntie Oogie Presents. And it's my new series that I am gearing towards my nieces and nephews, but anybody is welcome.
Yay. All right. Thanks, all.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you will join us on the first and third Friday of every month for our new episodes. To stay up to date on episodes, you can subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at TCP Theater Podcast. And we want to hear from you, so please leave us a review, or you can send us comments and questions through our social media, or you can reach us via email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater with
Alex Reed,
Anna Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Herrera,
Lilia Hushman,
Lupika Shah,
Oogie Push,
Saimuk Da Duampusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Wunsch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari,